This is a result that I was working on with a graduate student at the time, Justina Patel, who is now a postdoc at Oregon State University. She came to me when I was at Los Alamos, working with Matthew Hastings on completely different stuff. Well, but at the time we had started looking at something similar, which was the stability of commuting Hamiltonians, like the spectral gap of commuting Hamiltonians. Think of toric code and other such Hamiltonians where all the terms are commuting. So this is a generalization. I guess I'll go through some of the motivation, but just to give you an idea, when we are talking about stability of the spectral gap, really what we're interested in is, you know, once we have some Hamiltonian with local interactions with some like constant strength, we want to know whether if we add a perturbation, say that you want to engineer this Hamiltonian, you know, at some lab or something realistic like that, and you make mistakes, you know, you don't exactly engineer the interactions to be perfect, what if you have some local error of some constant strength, but throughout your system? Will that break your system? Will that break the ground state degeneracy, or will this close the gap and then you lose the nice properties of the ground state that you're hoping you are when you create the system? So this result really says that for a very large class of Hamiltonians under some type of like conditions, which seem to be both necessary and sufficient for proving stability, the spectral gap will not actually close even when you have the situation where you have impurities throughout the system. So let's see. Okay. So the challenge is to find a minimal set of assumptions under which gapped Hamiltonians have stable spectral gap against weak local perturbations, right? Because if the perturbation is not weak, then you could just break it, right? If the perturbation is not local, then you can create a very global perturbation and just flip like the ground state to an excited state. So you want really, this is kind of a necessary condition that they're kind of weak and local. But we'll see exactly what this means later on. Okay, so my mentor at Caltech, John Preskill, when I told him I had this exciting result, he said, so what? I mean, isn't every gap system stable? I mean, you know, we already knew that. The answer is no, not really, right? And these are some of the examples. Okay, so what happens when you break stability, right, of something that looks stable? One of the things that can happen is that you have some degenerate ground state space and you open the gap, right? You split the ground state subspace. So this is an example, which is the two-dimensional Ising Hamiltonian. And then we have this very small perturbing field, right? You know, this, the sum of the sigma z's over the whole lattice. Now, what happens here? So the ground state subspace is spanned by the all zero and the all one vectors, right? This has spectral gap one. And it's easy to see that because this is what is called a classical Hamiltonian, meaning that even though it is interacting, it can still be diagonalized in the same product basis, here zero ones. Okay, so you can see that because, let me see if this works, because these guys are all commuting, you know, the lowest energy you can get is with eigenvalues one and one here, or like minus one and minus one. So that's why you have these product states here. Okay. Now, the problem, though, is that once you add this little perturbation here, when I say little, I really mean like this is vanishing strength locally, right? This is one over the system size that you put here. You really break the stability of the ground state space. The degeneracy is lifted, right? You know, the all zero state is still going to have negative energy because we have a minus sign here, so it picks up some minus sum of these, but the all ones now has an energy of order one, right? So the problem with this is that this is one of our favorite classical memories, this 2D Ising model, because this it has this so-called energy barrier before you can flip all the spins from like the zero state to the one state. But it is a really bad quantum memory. Because once you have this very small perturbation here, then you have this relative, you know, phase when you start evolving with this Hamiltonian, because this has some energy, you know, say zero, and this has energy one. So you end up flipping from this encoded plus state to minus state, right? So that's bad. We don't want that. So what about closing the gap, which is usually what you think of, right, when you think of breaking stability? You know, some excited state comes crashing down, becomes a ground state, or vice versa. So this is another example. The simple example is just like the Ising Hamiltonian now, but it has a defect, right? It's right here. And it's at the origin, and what it does is it creates a unique ground state now, and the spectral gap is order one. It's actually exactly one again, just because of this guy here, right? And that would be for the state that has like the, you know, the all ones everywhere, right? But now we can distinguish these two states locally by using any one of these operators, right? The sigma z on any site, okay? And because of that, we can actually create like, you know, some simple perturbation with very small strength again of, you know, decaying at the order of the system size, so that the energy now of this guy comes crashing down becomes lower, because it has energy minus one for each one of these. This has energy one for each one of these guys. So you actually flip, you know, the relationship between this state and this state. So this becomes a ground state. This now is an excited state, right? So this is unstable. That's what we mean by having an unstable system, right? And both of these systems, I mean, they're commuting. They're classical. Right? They're supposed to be very easy to analyze, but yet here we thought every gap system was stable, right? These all have gaps, you know, energy of order one. So what happens? You know, what is the lesson from all of this, right? At least intuitively. The lesson is that Hamiltonians are unstable because you have some type of local order parameter, like the sigma z's that we have that could distinguish between the all zeros and all one state. And they can act as perturbations to really split either the ground state of the Hamiltonian or close the gap between the ground state, as we saw in the second counterexample, and some local low energy excitation, which was like, you know, the all one state, and it was only locally excited at this, at the origin, right, with this defect. At least this is the intuition, right? But can we prove that? Can we prove that this is really what goes wrong? And if we can combat these two things, then we're really done, right? You know, we can show that some system is stable. And the answer, thankfully, is yes. Right? For a large class of Hamiltonians, which is given by what is called frustration-free Hamiltonians. So these frustration-free Hamiltonians have the special property that the ground state, the global ground state, is actually a ground state of its local interaction, right? Hence the name frustration-free. So mathematically, you encode that in saying that this Hamiltonian here is the sum of these Hermitian operators, right? These local operators you can think of. And the eigenvalue of the ground state, this is an eigenvector of each one of these local interactions with minimum eigenvalue for each of these operators, okay? Now, of course, you can go and subtract this eigenvalue from this guy and make this positive. And then from now on, we will just consider that we've done that already. So we just shifted the energy of the spectrum by some constant, okay, which is the sum of all these minimum eigenvalues. And this is not going to change anything about related to the spectrum. Everything will still commute. It'll all be good. Okay, so something that many people are confused about, okay? Many famous people, actually. So they say, oh, but all commuting Hamiltonians are frustration-free, right? So, I mean, this is, no, that's not the case, okay? It is almost the case, but not quite. For example, if you take 3 qubits on the vertices of a triangle, right, you know, the usual idea of creating frustration, you take an Ising Hamiltonian for interactions between them, which means really like, you know, the sigma z interaction between any two of them, you will never be able to have a common eigenvector with eigenvalue minus one for all of these guys, right? Because, for example, this guy is the product of these two. So whenever this is minus one and this minus one, this has to be one. Here is like frustrating. Yes?
So there is another extreme example that every Hamiltonian in its spectral resolution.
It's a sum of community comparators, but it's not frustration free.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Yeah, you could. Yes.
It's not a local base.
Yeah, exactly. That's a, you're right. That's a good one, of course, yes. Yes. But usually people think, aha, but you know, that's cheating, you want it to be local, but you're right, absolutely right. Exactly. That's right. So there's the flip side. Yeah, but like, oh, maybe all frustration free Hamiltonians are actually commuting, so you haven't really done anything. You already proved last year that this is the case for commuting Hamiltonians, but that's not the case. Right? In fact, many interesting Hamiltonians, those so-called parent Hamiltonians of matrix product state or PEPs, things that you may have heard of already, like the ATLT model, they're frustration free and the terms are definitely not commuting. Right? So it's a larger class somehow, but still it doesn't include all of the commuting. In fact, something that people are confused about, we proved the result for commuting, for the commuting case, but we had to assume that it was also frustration-free, right? So, and I've, even like, you know, one of my co-authors thought, ah, it can't be that hard. I mean, you know, it's commuting, and, you know, we don't have to really assume frustration-free. We just subtract some stuff. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be that simple. So at least we will focus on this family right now. Okay, so this is one of the main pictures, right, of the talk. It took me like 10 minutes to make this. So it's pretty simple, I would say, right? You know, there is a full ground state. This is on some torus. That's my way of representing a torus, right? And then there is some local, a patch of the Hamiltonian, and the local ground state. Okay. Now, why do I have this picture here? Because every frustration-free Hamiltonian on this like large torus is an extension of another frustration-free Hamiltonian that is of interactions contained exactly within like, you know, some subset of the torus. Okay. And that implies that this local ground state actually contains this projection in here. I know it looks backwards, but really what it means is that whatever this ground state here, this projection onto the local ground state has to contain this guy here, which means really this relationship here. Okay. All right, so you're probably thinking, yeah, that's obvious, right? Well, just in case, but here is the proof, right? First, we recall that this Hamiltonian here is a sum, or can be written as a sum, of positive operators, right? And that implies then that the ground state really annihilates every single one of them. Well, the second thing that this implies is that this local Hamiltonian, the ones that we've removed everything outside of this subset B, is still some like positive operator and has some spectral gap that is strictly greater than zero, right? And then we can write this. This is the projection to the ground state, so this Hamiltonian is greater than or equal to, you know, it just satisfies this condition. It's very simple, right? It simply says that the smallest non-zero eigenvalue is this guy here, right? Orthogonal to the ground state. Okay, so then this implies that this is also zero, right? Just because this HB is the sum of even fewer terms, positive terms, right? So if this is already zero, this has to be zero. And then, just by using this and rewriting it backwards, and by sandwiching this inequality really, which we can do because we can transfer things on one side, with these positive operators, the projections, the ground state projections, we get this, right? Just because this is going to be zero, so this is going to be less than or equal to zero. To be pretty obvious. And remember, because this guy is positive, we can divide through and this doesn't change sign. Okay, but this implies that this guy is zero, right? This is a projection, so you can think of its square is itself, so this really is the same as saying something like this. Okay, so, and that's the end, really. That's the end, because that's exactly the same as what I had before once you multiply it out, right? So the ground state P naught is included in every other local ground state PD. But this only works for frustration-free Hamiltonians, and it actually seems to be kind of important for the proof. So, yes.
In the commuting case, the ground state projectors, you can just write them as a product of projectors.
Exactly. That's right.
But in this case, I mean, that is that not true? Or
it's
is
not
it,
true. And
I mean, obviously the order then matters.
Yes, exactly.
But
and not only that, but the detectability lemma, for example, tells you that if you were to do that, right, you would get the ground state as being the unique eigenvector with eigenvalue 1, but then you would have some lambda times, you know, the rest of the excited states. And that gap, this lambda, is exactly what gives you this exponential decay towards the ground state. If you were to take this projection you just said and raise it to some power, the you know, you would converge exponentially fast to the ground state.
Sorry, say again. So if you do take the product of the projectors
that's
on
right.
each of the terms,
you will get
you don't get a projector at all in general, I guess,
exactly.
in this case. That's
right.
the problem.
That's right.
But
which means you have extra excited
but,
states.
But the eigenvalue 1 subspace of that is the correct
that's right.
space.
Yes.
But then there's something
but you have
the
a bunch of other stuff, right? You know, that
yeah.
they don't have eigenvalue 1. And whatever, like, the second largest eigenvalue is, gives you this spectral gap. So, you know, if you use this operator, this single
uh-huh.
load projector, again and again, you get closer and closer to the ground state.
Actually,
and this
okay.
has some locality properties.
Okay.
But yeah. So. Okay, so how do I protect against the splitting of the ground states? Right? That was counterexample 1, you know? We need something. We need to be able to say, okay, you don't have any local way of distinguishing the two states. Well, this is the answer. You know, this is originally known as the Knill-Laflamme, I guess, error-correcting condition. But now we also know it as the topological quantum order condition, which says that once you are in the ground state subspace, every local operator, and by local I mean like up to some, you know, it has support on a ball of radius r around some site u, and up to some length L star, which is supposed to be the code distance, really, proportional to some power of the linear size, and that power is between 0 and 1, then all local operators look the same up to some constant, okay? Like, you know, this is the like the identity, okay? So what does this really mean? And why is it that the first example failed this condition? Okay, so you can get an idea of what this really, you know, implies, this condition. Well, let's see. So the Ising Hamiltonian does not satisfy this, and it does not satisfy it because this condition implies that any two ground states, any two, they don't even have to be orthogonal, have to have the same expectation value with respect to any local operator, right? If you put the same local operator here and here, for any two ground states, they have to have this constant as the expectation value, right? That's what it means. I mean, you can just read it off from right here just by applying psi naught, or phi naught on both sides here. Okay, so what happens for the Ising model? Well, you simply do that with any one of these operators. You get plus 1 for the 0 state, minus 1 immediately, a failure, total failure, right? Which is good because that explains why it was unstable, right? You know, it is no coincidence that we actually used exactly a sum of a bunch of these distinguishing operators to split the ground state, because the one picked up energy relative to the other state. That's all you need to do. Okay, so the good news is that we actually do know of Hamiltonians that do not fail this condition. Like, it has story code. It's a four-fold degenerate ground state subspace, and it satisfies the condition with this alpha equal to 1, which means that this like length, this code distance L star, is actually proportional to the linear size of the system. That really means, you know, as you probably know about the Tori code, that you only have these loop, string loop operators that have to go, that's why it's called, like, you know, the topological code, around the torus before you can actually flip one ground state to another. Okay. So there is another class of systems that satisfies topological quantum order, right? Which is ones with unique ground state, right? There is nothing to distinguish, right? It's a single one. Okay, so, but now you're thinking, well, the second counterexample had a unique ground state. It satisfied topological quantum order. What happened? You know, why did it, you know, the gap closed? It was unstable. The second one was the one with the defect, right? That said unique ground state of zeros. Yeah, but because of that defect there. So But okay, you know, you're thinking, well, unique ground state, there's nothing topological about it, it's just unique, right? What about the toric code? Can we break the toric code? Okay? Well, yes. So this toric code, quickly just to remind you, okay? You have a sum of plaquette and star terms. The plaquette terms, all the qubits live on the edges, here, 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 and here, the same thing. It's a bad drawing, by the way, but anyways. And these guys commute with all of these guys because they either do not intersect at any point or they intersect at an even number of points of qubits. So the anti-commutation relationship gives you commutation, right? Which really means that these terms here commute. So when you create the original toric code Hamiltonian of Kitaev, then you have all these terms commute among themselves, but they also commute in between, right? So what we know is that you can diagonalize in a common eigenbasis this Hamiltonian, right? And there are four ground states, okay? And they all satisfy this condition, right? There are four of these guys that have the stabilizing property that if you apply any one of these plaquette or star operators, nothing happens to them, okay? So as I said before, these guys satisfy topological order because only macroscopic string operators can distinguish between the two and flip from one to the other. These logical X and Z strings. So, okay, let's break it. So we have another parent Hamiltonian. This is no longer Kitaev Hamiltonian, but I will call it the Ising toric code with a defect model. Sounds nasty, but it's actually very simple. It's just an Ising Hamiltonian here, but it becomes the toric code, well, Ising with a defect from before, but toric code because we have these terms from before. The ground state subspace is still the toric code. So if you were to look at the ground state of this Hamiltonian, you would say, ah, this has got to be stable. In fact, we proved before this result came along that the original toric code Hamiltonian, the one I showed you before, is actually stable. Right? You know, it's a good Hamiltonian. But even though the ground state subspace is still the toric code, you can see it because only if you have one eigenvalue, plus one for everything, pretty much here, you actually get, you know, the lowest energy, right? Because if you have a minus one anywhere, either here you're going to pick up an energy or because of this little guy here, right? So is this gapped Hamiltonian stable? Probably know the answer, you know, as a break in the toric code. So it's not actually. If we perturb it with this thing I call the B field, right? This is the plaquette field, with a very small perturbation, proportional to inverse of the system size, of the lattice size, then things fail, right? Just like they failed for the second counterexample, the one, the Ising code with a defect, right? Again, this subspace here, with like eigenvalue plus one for the stars but minus one for the plaquettes, becomes the new ground state. Right? Why? Because this perturbation here overcomes this local defect, right? That said, oh, I don't want you to be a minus one because you pick up an energy here. Okay, it overcomes completely because of this positive contribution. Okay, so this means that topological order is not enough for stability either, right? It seemed to be good enough to keep the ground state subspace from splitting, but it won't help you from having an excited state come crashing down, right? Closing the gap. So what? What do we do? Well, you need a stronger version of topological order, it turns out. Okay. And that's called the local topological order, local ground state indistinguishability. So what does this say? It says exactly what the topological order said, but now for the local Hamiltonians. Right? The local Hamiltonians have to kind of have the same property, that their ground states also are indistinguishable locally, right? Just like before. For some local operator, this local ground state now has to look the same, this expectation value for any local ground state, up to some exponentially or rapidly decaying error. In fact, this function here could even be a fast enough polynomial decay. Right? So what is this like little L here? And he says that the further away you are from the boundary, or the closer, yeah, you're looking into the bulk of the system, which is the support of the local operator, the more indistinguishable the two ground states look, right? In other words, this means that the ground states on some space, you know, some lattice size or ball of radius r plus l, they're identical when viewed on the bulk A up to this error 2 delta. So for example, the all zeros in the all one state fails this again, you know, pretty badly, because when you look locally, one looks all zeros, the other one looks all ones. Okay. But the toricode ground state with the right parent Hamiltonian looks right, actually. It satisfies this, but not with the wrong local Hamiltonian that I showed you before, this Ising toricode with a defect. It fails because if you were to go away from the origin, where we had this B naught term, then everywhere away from the origin, the ground state looks like both sectors at the same time, both the toricode and this other, like, you know, the other one with all the plaquettes with minus one. Right? And this is the same as having, again, the old zeros and the old one state, which is easy to distinguish with some local operator. Yes?
Sorry, can you show again the first slide about TQO?
So
when you define the topological,
the original one?
Yeah, the original,
okay.
The non-local one.
The non.
So okay, yeah.
Oh, okay. Here. Or before this.
Any of these. So, but
okay.
You're already saying that a local operator cannot distinguish them.
That's right.
Which means that the local states are the same in a trace norm, right?
Yes.
And now the difference is
there
that
is a big
operator
difference. Thank you for asking that. No, it's actually, it is the same, but it's, the difference now lies in the fact that it's not just the global ground state that has satisfied this property. Every ground state of any local Hamiltonian now, right? Not just of the global Hamiltonian, but any sub-Hamiltonian, anyone defined on a subset of your spins, the ground states had to satisfy this property as well. It's again the same thing, that this implies that locally all the ground states will look the same, but you need a stronger condition. You need this condition to be true for all scales. Right?
I see. Okay.
That's the idea.
Exactly.
So that way you can avoid, you know, these little defects that you may put here and there that may locally distinguish, you know, two ground states. Right? So you don't want that. Okay, so let's see. So now that you have an idea what this is, let's try to prove this quickly so you get an even better intuition about this condition, which is what you were thinking probably of yours. So by definition of the trace norm and the definition of this reduced density matrix for some local ground state here, when I say local, I mean that this is not a full lattice, it's just some subset of spins, right? We have this relationship, right? The one norm can be thought of as, like, you know, the supremum over all operators of norm one of the trace of your state with that operator, okay? Which can be rewritten as this, because we have a difference of two of these guys, can be rewritten as this. But now, if you remember from before, the local TKO condition really implies that both this and this are equal to this constant, right? Up to some small error. Really, that's what the condition means, that they all have the same expectation value up to some small error, right? Well, then you just use the triangle inequality instead, you know, and you're done. So, yes.
Sorry,
yes.
So, say 1A is the new ground state for a smaller system.
Exactly.
It's not obtained by tracing up anything.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. And as long as you still have a degenerate subspace for this local ground state space, you have to worry about this condition. That's right. So it doesn't come from, you know, the full ground state space, right? The global one. Okay. So there's another corollary of this definition, which makes me think that it's actually probably a useful condition or definition, this local detail. Any ground state now of the full Hamiltonian that satisfies this local TKO condition actually also satisfies a bound for the entanglement entropy of the state on any reduced region A. And in particular, if this A is just a ball of radius R, then we have this bound here, right? It's 1 plus R to the D minus 1, right? So if it's a D-dimensional system or torus, then one less dimension. But you have this little L naught here, this thickness. Right, you know, this is almost like a correlation length. And this L naught is exactly defined as the minimum distance up to which this decay is faster than just, you know, L over 1 plus the radius. Right. So to kind of give you an idea, for most commuting terms, most commuting Hamiltonians, and in particular the toric code or some classical system, this decay delta here can be proven to be a step function. The moment that L is larger than 1 or some constant, it becomes exactly 0 and remains there, right? Which means that this L naught really is a constant for these cases, which then implies that for all of these ground states, you actually have a bona fide area law, right? It's just some constant times this scaling here. But in case that this is an exponential decay, like it turns out to be for the parent Hamiltonians, like of matrix product states, and for other class of Hamiltonians too, then you have a logarithmic correction here, log of 1 plus r, right? So that's fine, because we never assumed a gap when we're discussing this. So you may actually have that in general, some logarithmic correction to the area law, even in one dimension, right? So it seems to be kind of an interesting little corollary that comes directly from a definition. OK, so there's a second condition that also seems to be necessary, even though kind of contrived. So there's this local gap condition that says that your Hamiltonian H naught, right, will have some Hamiltonians of which it is an extension, as I was saying before, these HBs, right? And it's one of them. This B, say, is a ball of radius R. It will have this spectral gap, gamma, that I also had defined before. As long as this gap decays at most polynomially in the radius of the support, then we say that it satisfies the local gap condition, right, this H naught. So that's all we mean. Like, you know, as long as you don't have some exponential decay of the spectral gap with respect to, you know, the size of your support, you're fine. Now, there are two open problems here, and I think they're both true, but I don't know how to prove them. One is the local gap condition always satisfied if this Hamiltonian here is the sum of local projections with some frustration-free ground state and some spectral gap, right? I can come up with counterexamples to this if this H naught is not the sum of local projections, and it's just the sum of some positive terms, but they may have very small norm individually, right? They may have a zero eigenvalue, but then the next eigenvalue may be decaying with the system size. So that's why also this is a necessary condition for stability. And the second thing is local TKO, the other independent condition, is it actually important for proving this in this setting here, right? So you only really need one condition. You don't need two conditions. Well, I don't know. OK, so let's go into a brief history of stability, right? Let's start from the beginning. It was Euclid who first developed Hamiltonian theory, I think, back in 340. But I'm not sure about that. But why do I put Euclid up there? Because the very first thing you do when you learn about perturbation theory and like stability of the spectral gaps is you use the triangle inequality, right? To say that, okay, if the total norm of your perturbation is less than half the gap, then just by a simple triangle inequality argument, you can show that the gap has not closed, okay? Now, why is this, like, the talk I'm giving right now interesting at all? Because what I'm considering is cases where this, like, norm diverges with the system size, right? Remember, this perturbation is allowed to be such that each individual term, not the whole norm, but each individual local term has a constant strength. So if you were to add them up all together, you would get some norm that is extensive in the system side, right? So forget about being upper bounded by some constant, some small constant for that matter. Okay, so we can't exactly use that, but we do, in fact, towards the end of the proof. We'll see. Okay, second, thousands of years later, I guess. Well, actually, there was Kato, so we did some amazing work in perturbation theory, but you know, continuity and so on and so forth. But there were some very interesting results by Data and co-authors, and then Yarotsky, back in 2000. And they considered the following problem, very non-trivial result. It says, once you have this H naught that is a sum of classical terms, just like the cases that I discussed earlier, the first two counterexamples, right, the Ising Hamiltonians, they were all classical in the sense that the eigenstates were all on the same in the same product basis, okay, of zeros and ones, say. So in this case, if you have a gap and a unique frustration-free ground state, you always need this frustration-free condition, then if you have a perturbation that looks like this, where these terms are centered on, you know, the different lattice points u, and they're exponentially decaying, right? Meaning that these guys are sums of terms with increasing support, but rapidly decreasing, exponentially decreasing norm. Then as long as the norm of each one of these guys here is less than constant, which is chosen so that it's stable, then this actually, the gap is open, remains open. This is much more powerful than the Euclidean result, okay? So this is the first attempt, and I've classified as the common product eigenbasis stability, right? So the classical case. The second one was about a year and a half ago, and was work with Sergey Bravi and Matthew Hastings, and we tried to tackle the problem of whether the Tori code was stable, right? The spectral gap, for obvious reasons. You want to use it as a quantum memory and so on and so forth. So we're able to show that for all, actually, Hamiltonians that are sums of commuting projections, not just the Tori code, and that have a spectral gap and they're frustration-free, right? As long as the ground state subspace satisfies some form of this local topological order, then again, for the perturbation via sum of rapidly decaying terms, there exists some constant strength J naught that implies that the gap is still stable, right? As long as you don't increase your perturbation strength too much, you're fine, okay? The gap will still be open. So this is what I call the common eigenbasis. So we're moving along, right? We went from common product eigenbasis to just common eigenbasis with this, like, this condition. You see now the local gap condition is not needed, because when you have a sum of commuting projections, all the gaps are one, or at least one, actually, right? They're commuting projections, so you just add up the eigenvalues. Okay, and what you're hearing about today is this one. So we remove the assumption of commuting, right? And again, the same things. But now we have this local topological order and local gap conditions that I described already. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so the perturbations look like this. That's all I'm going to say, right? They just rapidly decay visually too. And mathematically, this is what it means, that each one of these, the large perturbation is a sum of these centered perturbations, and each centered perturbation is a sum of these other ones with extended support. But as the support extends, this rapidly decaying function says that the norm decays, okay, for some constant j. Okay, so the main result. The main result is that if you have a frustration-free Hamiltonian satisfying the local TQO and local gap conditions with this delta decay and gamma decays that you saw before, and if you assume periodic boundary conditions and a spectral gap, for any perturbation that has strength j and decay f, you have that the spectral gap of the perturbed Hamiltonian is bounded below by this weird looking thing here, okay? Now, there are two components that are interesting here. First, I will go through the large component. This component is actually the nice one. This decays really fast in the system size. Even though you have this polynomial explosion here, L to the D, these guys decay exponentially usually. This guy and this guy here are functions that decay exponentially in this length L star. And remember that this L star was either proportional to the system size or some like, you know, power of it, like square root of L. So this goes to zero really fast as you increase your system size. And in fact, this theorem tells you that, you know, as the linear size increases, this bound becomes tighter and tighter. Okay. Now the interesting part is this one. This is the original gap, but it has a multiplicative factor. And it says that there is some constant, which is explicit, says that as long as this j is less than 1 over that constant, right, or maybe 1 over 2 times that constant, you actually still have a gap of order like, you know, gamma over 2, say, right? Now, what is this constant? This is all the meat of the proof. This constant is given explicitly as this sum for the different radii here from 1 through the system size of r to the d times this ratio. Now, this gap is exactly this local gap here. So if this is polynomial, this just becomes polynomial decay, becomes another polynomial power up here. But this guy here better decay fast enough so that this is a constant, right? And it usually does. In fact, if your perturbation is local or exponential decaying, this guy here decays as a sub-exponential, which means like e to the minus square root of r or something like that, right? So it's definitely, this is definitely a constant in all the cases we're interested in. And there is a second result, obviously, that says that the ground state splitting, the first way to break stability, opening the gap, is bounded above by, again, this quantity. Okay, well, half of this quantity, actually. So again, the splitting, as we know for topologically ordered systems, is exponentially small. Okay? Well. So I only really have time to show you one of the tools, which is, well, it's hot stuff. That's what I'm going to say. Right? This is an important tool that Matthew Hastings developed, and we applied it to many different problems. And we now call it the spectral flow, but really it is Hastings' quasi-adiabatic evolution. And just for historical reasons, I will just explain quickly why it was called originally quasi-adiabatic evolution. Well, let me just go through the definition here. It is some unitary operator that is generated through this like differential equation with this special generator that is supposed to simulate the generator of the adiabatic evolution, right? So say that you have some path that is gapped between like, you know, two Hamiltonians, then there is some unitary that rotates one ground state to the ground state of the other Hamiltonian, right? This is, if you go slowly enough, there is this like adiabatic evolution. But this may not be generated with some nice unitary, or at least one that has local properties, okay, or local decomposition. And the reason why Matt decided to call this quasi-adiabatic evolution, as far as I understand, is because originally this did not simulate a generator exactly. It has some error, right? Yeah, because we needed some other properties of locality, but we had to give up the fact that you didn't exactly rotate to the ground state, you rotated to something like the ground state, so to speak. In fact, now we call it a spectral flow because by advancing the mathematical, I guess, techniques behind this, we're able to show that you can actually do this exactly and still have all the nice properties you wanted and even more. So what is this thing? What is this? It's all about this generator. Otherwise, I haven't shown you anything. Well, it is written by this beautiful double integral here. And all the meat is right here. There's this filter function that has the following properties, okay? It has compact Fourier transform, okay? Meaning that if the frequency is greater than half the gap of the system, then it is exactly zero, right? But also, it has really fast decay, almost as fast as it gets, mathematically speaking, in time, right? So it is compactly supported in frequency, but it's almost exponentially decaying in time. You can never get exponential decay in time if you have compact support. It's the Paley-Wiener theorem that tells you your function has to be all zero then everywhere. Right? There's no other way. But we've gotten as close as possible almost. We could do a little better with these logs here, but whatever. So sub-exponential decay, right? And it is normalized so that the integral of this function is 1. Or really that at 0, this Fourier transform is 1. and it's positive, so that this guy here is Hermitian, right? So why is this an interesting representation, and why is this generator nice? It is nice because, remember, this V here is actually a sum of quasi-local terms, right? Of exponentially decaying terms itself. It's a sum over different like sides U, and for each one of them, you know, this V sub U really decays exponentially. And because of what we call Lib-Bromson bounds, the fact that this evolution here, this Heisenberg evolution, actually does not see the whole system at the same time, right? So for small times, this operator here is actually kind of local. And also because for large times, this exponential decay here just kills off anything outside this light cone, we actually can show that this generator here is actually a sum of almost exponentially decaying terms, which is very nice, because then we can prove stuff because of that. And the truth is that this function actually exists, okay? This filter function here. Because for a long time, you know, we were hunting for that function, going back and forth, believing that it existed, and other times that it didn't exist. So, kind of to give you an idea, when we first wrote, well, there were two papers that proved that the Tori code was stable. The original paper is the one, you know, that I was an author as well, and it was about 40-something pages, and we had to go through some nasty math and commutators. And then because of pretty much the existence of this little guy here, it came down to 15 pages, the proof. So it makes a big difference, this little math here. Yes.
This filter function, you get the adiabatic evolution instead of the quasi-adiabatic, or still called
quasi-adiabatic? Exactly, because of this property here, the support being compact,
yeah.
You get exact, and I will show you exactly what that means.
Okay,
and you don't get some error.
So the original quasi-adiabatic evolution, there is no such filter function.
There is, but it was an exponential, a Gaussian, actually. It was a Gaussian decay. And so because the Fourier transform of the Gaussian was another Gaussian, you always had some leakage into things outside of the ground state subspace. But also, the problem was that because if you wanted that, you could never really get such a good decay, or at least that's what we thought. We didn't want to use that, so we gave up on something. Okay, so what is this spectral lemma, and what do I mean by this local decomposition? This is a very important lemma that we've used like for many things, not just the stability results. And it says that once you have a family of differentiable Hamiltonians that is gapped, and this is a sum of local terms, the ones we are considering, for example, if P of S denotes a projection onto the eigenstate of this Hamiltonian within some energy range, some E minimum and E maximum, right? So you're within this like energy band. And if this energy band is separated from the rest of the spectrum by at least some gap gamma, or gamma over 2 here, for all s between 0 and this upper bound s star, as long as you have, as you notice, then you actually know that this unitary, this spectral flow that I discussed earlier, generated by this D of s, gives you exactly this subspace, not just the ground state space, any subspace that satisfies this condition, starting from 0. Right? You know that if you start with something that you already know, maybe some like product state basis or whatever, then this unitary will actually give you exactly the subspace, the relevant subspace at time s. That's why we also call it the spectral flow, because it really tells you how this like spectral subspace flows through time if time is s. Okay, and there's this nice unitary that has local properties. For example, we can prove that this generator here is quasi-local in nature. I kind of gave you an idea of why that was, right, kind of quickly. And that the spectral flow satisfies that it is really close. This unitary can be approximated very well for some rapidly decaying function here, with the product of two unitaries acting on disjoint sets, right? And another unitary that couples the two of them, right? And what do I mean by this, like, partial A? I mean that you have a thickness L around the boundary of this region A, and this is only where this operator acts, right? So think of like two unitaries transforming your states individually, and then you hit them with another unitary just acting on the boundary between these two regions. And the larger the boundary, the thickness, the closer you are to the actual adiabatic one. Okay, so I think we have a little bit of time for the proof, but this will be an overview. Cannot go into any of the details, unfortunately. So we assume that we start, you know, we have some value S of this adiabatic parameter for the A sub S. This S star, that is the largest value for which, as long as you're going from 0 to this S star, right, the family of Hamiltonians, HS, this one, has a gap that is at least gamma over 2, right? So this is supposed to be the maximum value, which means that right after S star, your gap becomes smaller than gamma over 2. Let's just assume that, right? And also, we can assume that S star is not equal to 1. Because if it is equal to 1, then we have H0 plus V, and we've assumed away what we are trying to prove anyways, right? If it is equal to 1, then we have a gap. You know, it's at least gamma over 2. So let's just assume that it's some value smaller than 1, and it's the maximum such value, okay? So that's important because then we can start using the spectral flow and all that stuff that assume that we have a family of gapped Hamiltonians, right? We don't know what this S star is. It may be, like, really small, you know, and may decay with the system size. We don't know. Now we're going to use something called energy filtering, which is another powerful tool that takes any gapped Hamiltonian and creates something almost like a frustration-free Hamiltonian out of it, right? But in particular, what it does is it'll take our Hamiltonians, these guys here, and it will rewrite the terms in such a way so that each term now is quasi-local. It's not local anymore, but say exponential decaying, but it commutes with the ground state of this Hamiltonian. This is what this is. This is the ground state subspace of this Hamiltonian. So it kind of block diagonalizes, right, the Hamiltonian for each individual term, right? No longer just the sum of all of them, so the whole Hamiltonian, each individual term. Almost like the idea of with frustration-free systems, but, you know, in this sense. Okay, so the third step is we use this unitary, right, this spectral flow, right? And we transform unitarily this gap family of Hamiltonians that we have rewritten like this into something that looks like this. Okay, we extract again the original Hamiltonian, but then we have the sum of these new terms, V prime sub U. Okay, so why do we do that? Because of the properties of this unitary, we actually know that each one of these guys now, these local guys here, commutes with the original ground state. Okay, so it's almost like we took this random, you know, perturbation, this V, we added it to original Hamiltonian, but then we unitarily transformed it into something that looked like it was frustration-free, or it had these nice properties of the original Hamiltonian H0, right? And of course, the important thing with this, like, locality that I've been talking about is that these guys are still quasi-local. They decay really fast. Okay, so this is important because this Hamiltonian has the same exact spectrum as this Hamiltonian, right? It's just a unitary transformation. So if we can prove a spectral gap for this guy here, we have it for H sub S. Okay, so we can go back and forth now. Okay, now we're going to do an energy shift, right? We're going to extract some energy from the system, but it's not going to change anything because it's this global energy shift. It just shifts all the energies. The gaps remain exactly the same, not just the spectral gap, but any other, like, higher energy gaps. We break it into three parts. The one that is acting on the ground state, the one that is acting on the excited states, and the constant energy. It's supposed to be the energy of the Hamiltonian of this term here at the ground state. Okay. So why do we do that? Because we can now use this local topological order condition. In fact, in this instance, to prove that this delta one, right, the one that is the one acting on the ground state, we only need the global topological order, the Torrey code style topological order, right? To prove that this actually decays really fast with L star, this almost linear size of the system. So this, which means that this is just a small perturbation. We can use Euclid at this point, okay, to prove that the gap is stable, because this is in norm, decays very fast. And even the sum of all of these guys with the triangle inequality, even if you have L to the D of them, because this is really fast in this, it still goes to zero rapidly. Okay, so the more important step is to show that this W part, the one acting on the excited state, is a strength J perturbation with also rapid decay W, the one that I showed when I presented what the main result was, right? And it satisfies this local annihilation condition. The local ground states, which are acting on the support of this guy here, kill off each one of these terms. Exactly zero, right? It's very non-trivial. The original perturbation had nothing like that in it. And now we use this local gap condition, that's where it comes in, and this local annihilation condition here to prove that the sum of all of these little perturbations on W has energy for any state that is upper bounded relative to the energy of that state with respect to the original Hamiltonian. So this is called the relative bound. And that is very important when you're trying to prove that the spectrum doesn't change too much when you add something to it. Okay, because it may change in an absolute way, but not relative to some other Hamiltonian, like H0 in this case. Okay, so we're almost done. Now, the relative bound and the small perturbation imply that this Hamiltonian now, right, the one where we extracted the energy, has spectral gap greater than 3/4 gamma. That is absolutely greater than what we assumed, the gamma over 2 gap, right? We said, let's just assume that up to S star, the gap is gamma over 2, but then after that, it goes down, right? Now we have a contradiction here. We have a contradiction because this Hamiltonian and this Hamiltonian have the same spectral gap. They have, in fact, all spectral gaps are the same for these two Hamiltonians, right? It's just an energy shift of this Hamiltonian, and this was just a unitary transformation of this guy here, right? But now we said that this Hamiltonian has a spectral gap that is greater than this Hamiltonian is supposed to have for S is equal to this S star, right? That's a contradiction. And the only thing we assumed was that S star was really less than 1, because if it was 1, we're done, right? Which means that, and this is the important part, as long as this strength J is less than this J naught, which actually allows you to prove this bound here, then actually S star is equal to 1. So you can perturb all the way to S is equal to 1, and you will be fine. The gap will be at least 3/4 gamma. And that's really the proof. It's kind of like this bootstrapping argument. But the key is that because of all these things we've done here and this relative bound, we can prove that as long as this J is small, smaller than some constant, then the gap is actually larger than what we independently assumed, which gives this contradiction. It says you have to go back and reevaluate what you were doing. So this is it. So I will end with some open problems, right? The first one is, how do we actually prove spectral gaps in two dimensions for frustration-free Hamiltonians? There is the AKLT model on the two-dimensional honeycomb lattice. It would be very nice to know if it has a spectral gap. It will also make my result more interesting if there is something in two dimensions that we know has a spectral gap and is frustration-free. In one dimension, we have a lot of nice results by Bruno Nachtergale, for example, using what is called the martingale method to prove that most matrix product state parent Hamiltonians actually have this local gap condition and a gap in the thermodynamic limit, as long as some condition is satisfied. So that proves stability of these quantum phases in one dimension, which is nice.
So you mean it would be interesting to find older 2D models other than the quantum double models, huh?
Exactly.
Because
so frustration-free, yeah.
You have frustration-free in the
That's right. Time. But you need, in order to have stability, to even talk about stability, you need to have a gap in the first place, right, that does not close with the system size. So
right.
Interesting.
Right, and these custom models, you already know that it has a spectral gap.
Yes, exactly.
The quantum double. So
That's
you want,
right.
You want more than
That's
other
right.
models.
All the models. Mm-hmm. Let's go crazy. Okay, so the second question is, what symmetries of the Hamiltonian, like say translation invariance or scale invariance or something like that, what if these symmetries imply this local topological order condition? Because I don't want to have to prove it individually for each system. Okay, this may not be so simple, even though it gives you some nice intuition to look at why this is the case, why this is satisfied, this condition, for say matrix product states. Okay. Third, can we prove that the local gap for all frustration free Hamiltonians, like I was asking earlier, as long as there are sums of local projections? I think that's also true. I have some students at Caltech working on this, but you know, it seems hard. I thought maybe the detectability lemma, these new ideas we have about approximating these ground states, would give me something new, but it's not so simple. But everybody tells me it's true, including Preskill and GitHub, so it must be true, right? I've asked the oracles. Okay, so this is something else that I think is pretty interesting here, right? This local TKO condition implies an area law. I already told you about this, you know, earlier, right? But also it implies stability of the gap, right? The stability of the gap actually can be shown to imply that the area law is preserved, right? This entropy bound does not change too much as you're changing the, you know, you're increasing the perturbation as long as the gap is preserved. That can also be shown. So the question then becomes, under what conditions does the area law imply the local topological order condition? And what does this even mean? Right, you know, how can you, what does it mean for a ground state to satisfy this local TKO if we already saw that the ground state, the global ground state alone cannot do this, right? You can have different para-Hamiltonians with the same ground state. One of them would satisfy this condition with very fast decay and the other one would just fail completely the condition. Like with the case of this, you know, Ising Tori code with the defect. And actually, this is what brings me to this next question. Is there such a notion as a frustration-free parent Hamiltonian, like a class of parent Hamiltonians that are better than the others? No, in the sense that they encode the same ground state, but they have, they're really the true parent Hamiltonians, okay? They're not faking it somehow. And I think the best way of classifying what, who, which ones those Hamiltonians should be comes from which ones have the optimal decay delta, this delta naught. Right? For example, Kitaev's story code Hamiltonian is optimal in that sense, that it has this step function. Right? You know, that you can show that the topological order kicks in after you're a constant away from the boundary of the region you're looking in. I don't know. I think, you know, this is an interesting question. So this is the end. This is the time for your questions. And thank you for listening.
Yes. So, sorry, I didn't understand. For the how is it possible that, so the area that you said, what, under what conditions the area law would imply local TQO, but I mean, that's so far from being true, I don't know why you'd even think about it, right? I mean.
So why would you say that?
Well, I mean, there's lots and lots of states,
yes,
that satisfy area law that don't satisfy anything like topological order.
Like which one? Are
well,
you talking
like
about classical states?
Right.
Exactly. Very good. So remember that they satisfy, even those can satisfy the local TKO condition, even though they have no topological order. It's like the way I defined it as topological order, local topological order, is, I agree, is not the best way to name it. Because once you have a unique ground state at all scales, it satisfies the condition, but it may be a product state. Right?
No. I mean, like the real Ising model.
OK. But think of the ground state, think of what the right Hamiltonian is, right? For, say, the product state that is the all zeros. It's not the Ising one, right? This is not stable, as we show. And it doesn't have a very good local topological order. I mean, it fails, actually. Right? It has area law, but it fails. You're right. But what if you just took the sum of, like, you know, the sigma z's? Right? That would actually satisfy local TKO. And it would actually show you also that, you know, this, right? You know,
because it's unique.
Exactly.
Yeah,
at all
sure.
scales. Exactly. So it would actually have very good properties in the sense that there is very strong local topological order, even though it's unique. Product state. But that's what I mean. I agree. The first time, actually, it was Frank Perstrader who said, oh, but what about the other way? I said exactly the same thing. No, come on. You have a product state here, you know, and it fails. But the question is, what is the right parent Hamiltonian? Because that is what defines the local TKO. And when I said area law implies local TKO, I meant at the optimal case. you give me the best pair in Hamiltonian, can you find a counterexample?
Well, okay, so let me make a suggestion for the best pair in Hamiltonian. It's probably doesn't quite work, but maybe it's at least the right way to go, which is...
The reduced density matrix.
Yeah, but you have to then add terms, I mean, not the reduced density matrix, but the projection on the support.
That's right, exactly. That's right.
But then you, of course, you have to add terms as you get bigger and bigger, and at some point you cut off, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's, I mean, that's exactly what we do with the MPS and the PEPs, right? You know.
Right.
That's exactly the idea, that's right. But I wonder if that's why I said frustration-free case, because if it's frustrating, maybe you can't even do that because you can't locally connect the patches consistently when you do that. But I wonder if you can always do that for frustration-free Hamiltonians. The moment that you hit some injectivity length or some correlation, beyond some correlation length, then you can always put these patches together as you're suggesting.
Sorry, I mean, you can always put them together because you know the state exists, but the question is, can you cut them off? That
yeah, that like maybe you're including something else, you know, at that point, right? If you don't do...
If you don't include the whole thing.
Yeah. But you're right, that's a good idea, yeah. Yes?
So I tried a bunch of this.
Okay.
So we can talk about some of
where
the
string
theory,
is
but
that your question? Okay.
one question is, beside this last slide where you bring this concept up about symmetry.
Yes.
So I do not think that the answer to the question can be positive. And I don't think that you can have symmetry conditions for finding topological objects.
Okay.
But so this is just a set comment, but
maybe I should clarify something. May I have just a moment to clarify? I have not found a parent Hamiltonian of some ground state so far, some frustration-free case, where I can create some counterexample that is translation invariant and it breaks the local TKO condition. That's why I put that up there. But I have an idea of what you're saying. Is like if you have some local symmetry, then you can't have topological order, you know. But
okay, so we can talk about
that.
Going to symmetry, so. It seems to me that symmetry can play a role if you use it as a restrictions for the type of perturbations that you're using.
Yes.
Because, so your theorem is very nice and general because you're not assuming anything about the perturbations. But on the other hand, like for instance, when you split the genetic ground states, it's because you break the symmetry.
Exactly.
So it would be nice to have rigorous results when you say, okay, but if I restrict the symmetry, then...
We do. That also follows from the proof. That's like, actually, it's so easy that it's just like a paragraph at the end of the paper. That the moment that you restrict to a symmetry-protected sector that satisfies this local PTO condition, right? Those are the only operators that actually need to satisfy, then everything goes through. Because all the construction and all the perturbations, they all commute with with that symmetry. They all satisfy it. So everything just goes through beautifully. And which means that, yes, you wouldn't have instability for the original Ising, you know, counterexample if you only considered, you know, some like, you know, quadratic type of thing or something that respected that symmetry between the states. You're right. Yeah.
So, and the second question is there any way to extend, which I think that would be very important, these results to the case in which the local Hilbert space is infinite dimensional?
Yes.
Of course, you cannot write norms like that.
Yes.
But still.
Yes, no, I think that's a very good question. And because we already know of, one of the main tools is the Lib-Rommsen bounds that we use, right? And we actually know that these even exist in certain cases where you have locally like infinite spaces. That would be very interesting to look into that. Yes. But I'm so tired after working on this result that I will hope somebody else will look into this. But yes, I think you wanted something.
Yeah, I was wondering. This is finite dimensional, but in the context of quantum field theory, the question has come up of perturbations of Hamiltonians that are discontinuous, and John Crowder is an expert in this very field.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, it has proven useful to look at it both from the operator perspective, but also from the path integral perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked at your conditions from a path integral point of view?
I have not.
Because you see, from a path integral point of view, perhaps the the local versus non-local business comes up naturally.
Mm-hmm. Would that be, I don't know if you're familiar with the contour and cluster expansion methods. Would that be, because it sounds like when you say path integral, sounds mm-hmm. of the similar flavor, which is what they have used so far up to, you know, the techniques we started using with this quasi-robotic evolution business to prove stability, like data and the others, is this very powerful, but still, you know, just, it was about 80 pages to prove something easier than this, which is proved in like 15 pages. So I wonder, like, they must have used some other techniques, but it had to do with cluster expansions. And then it becomes difficult to, because you have to really go in there and do all the combinatorics, make sure that you're not missing something when you're bounding all these norms. So it may come up more naturally, but it also, like, you kind of lose perspective, I think, when you go into the expansion. So I don't know. But I would say that this technique, at least the techniques we're using here, do not help us with answering another, as far as I know now, another very difficult and important problem, which is what happens when the temperature is not zero. This is all at zero temperature, right? What about thermal fluctuations? And this other technique, maybe like what you're discussing, actually is more amenable to showing stability against thermal fluctuations for very simple systems. So.
Another thing that just came to mind when you discussed this quasi-adiabatic flow, where you're interpolating, where you have coming up with this adjoint operator that would generate some change.
Yes.
It reminds me a bit of an issue that can come up in discrete time quantum warp. When you know you go from one step to the next by unitary, but you may want to generate it continuously. You may want to have a Hamiltonian that does this.
Yes.
Does this unitary in a finite amount of time.
Uh-huh.
And then there are many Hamiltonians that do it because you can interpolate the finite time step in any number of ways. I was wondering whether perhaps the particular way you did it here might be a model for you could do it there because you see if you have a finite time discrete time quantum
yes.
You want it to be local.
Yes.
And you take the unitary that takes you from one time to the next time, and you just naively take sort of the logarithm of it to get the Hamiltonian that does it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not going to be local.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe you can.
Yeah.
This was things to get it local.
If you remember, there was this part here that I showed. This right here. I think this result is relevant here. Because it says that this, if you were to start from some product state, and then you perturb it with a Hamiltonian, right, then this unitary will give you the state at the end. Right? Once you apply this unitary to the product state, you will get. But this decomposition here, it kind of gives you an idea of a circuit, right? That on the first layer you have these guys that are disjoint. On the second layer you have something that acts on their supports, right? And then, of course, you could continue doing this. You could split this again into like products with something else on top, and so on and so forth. Maybe this circuit. And of course, at its level, you make some error. But you know, if this is fast enough decay, then you're going to be all right. So, you, at least from the local point of view, you could think of okay, first I do something here, and then something here. Locally rotate the basis if the two components were disconnected, and then I act with something in between and keep doing that. But where this is the same generator that does a discrete, I don't know. Again. Any questions about this? Or objections? No.
Yeah, I have an objection to the string theory.
All right. What do you think? Okay, I have a question.
I don't think it's anywhere on the right. I think the string theory is not anywhere on the right.
Okay, where would you put it?
Somewhere very far on the left.
On the left? Wow, I see. I didn't say anything. Okay.